Thank you very much indeed, Andrew, for that very kind welcome. And indeed, with you and Hector here and looking round at the audience, I really feel among friends. I recognize a number of faces, and I always enjoy my visits here very much. It's wonderful to see how the college here has grown. I remember those early days at Murray College and hearing from you all then about the vision. And my goodness, that vision has been turned into reality. It's a particularly good time to come because this past year seems to have seen something. I almost said the dialogue between the science and religion, but I'm not quite sure if it is a dialogue. If one party grabs the other by the scruff of the neck and hits them over the head, I'm not quite sure that that is exactly dialogue is the right word. And theology, religion has been on the receiving end quite a lot in this past year. However, it's strange in this world how light and darkness sometimes interchange, because on March the 9th of this year, a truly remarkable event happened. Such a remarkable event that my theme is going to build up to it, rather than mentioning what it is, because it's an event that I think puts a huge new building block into thinking about science, but a potential building block for the relationship between science and theology. Rather than introducing it right from the start, I want to kind of build up to it, to say how I approached it and how I came to it, and when I saw the paper, the ideas that had been produced on March the 9th, why I recognized immediately that somebody had done something quite brilliant. I want to start and set the scene a little bit by looking at this whole relationship between science and religion, but also between science and society, and the crisis we seem to be in at the moment, two crises which seem to coincide. There's a fascinating book written by a Nobel Prize winner, Ilya Prigozhin, Russian originally, who went to live in Belgium, died some years ago. He wrote it along with Isabel Stengers. A lot of it's quite technical. It's called Order Out of Chaos. But in it, there's some very deep thoughts. And in a way, one could almost, rather than read the book, it's almost to pick out maybe a total of 2 pages of particular quotes. And one of his quotes, he says, "It's strange how we have a crisis in the world today, a global crisis, but we have a crisis in the nature of science as well." Well, of course, the global crisis has been becoming even more aware to us all over the past few months. But there's a crisis in science as well. The global crisis, we know, it's the question of whether or not the human race will overcome material greed and tackle the consequences that come with material greed, a material approach. But then one could say, well, if the human race has become so material that the human race cannot even realize the material consequences of its present actions in terms of the global environment it's destroying, let alone the spiritual consequences, if the human race has become so obsessed with the material world, so rooted in the material world, what's been happening to its thinking processes to allow it to get into that state? And then one again looks at one of the areas of its thinking processes, which is science, and says, what's going on? The problems with science, a flawed science at the moment, come in with two particular types. The one is the social, and the other is the technical. The social problem is the fact that somehow this colossal physical material power is there in science, but apparently no rule book as to what to do with it. There is a school of thought in science, and it sounds quite unbelievable even to say it, but there are a number of scientists who actually say that they have no responsibility whatever for the consequences of the uses that society makes. In other words, that science is intrinsically has no intrinsic values, and it doesn't matter whether you make medical cures or whether you make bombs. What society does with them, whether they use the cure or whether they kill people, is immaterial. It's a bit like saying, if I invent fireworks and I hand it to a room of children, it's not my fault if the children threw them at each other or neighbors. It's their parents' fault, nothing to do with me. I just make them. that particular approach, you can see, is not exactly one that's going to get us as a human race very far. But it's there. The question is, how is it that we can have a system of knowledge without actually a system of judgment about its practical applications? But there are also huge technical problems deep in science, very fundamental, profound technical problems about the very nature of science. We have a problem which shows itself up in the technical question of how do we match quantum theory, the theory of the very small, with relativity, the theory of the very large. And it turns out people have been trying to do this for nearly 80 years. Technically, it seems very, very difficult to do. In fact, the theories seem to be fundamentally inconsistent. And they're inconsistent not simply that the numbers don't work out. They're inconsistent in that the concepts at the very heart of them don't actually seem to fit together. That in some way, the language that we use for concepts like space, time, matter, and energy in the one are different, fundamentally different from the concepts in the other. Well, that is a serious technical problem. But there's some even more glaring ones, things that the average person can say there's something wrong there. For example, in science, we build a great deal around something called the second law of thermodynamics, which is very profound in its title and it seems very advanced, but all it really says is that if I was, as an experiment, to drop this water, which I don't intend to do, if I drop this actually onto the floor, that happens in the world, but we notice in the world that water doesn't come back into a glass. If I drop this glass on a hard floor and it's smashed into pieces, and it gets, in other words, more chaotic and more disordered. Those kind of processes happen in the world rather than ordered ones. In other words, the second law says, and we can see this happening to a certain extent in day life, if something can go wrong, it will. If something can get a bit more chaotic and a bit more difficult and things break down. But then we say, just a moment, the scientists are telling us this, and they lift up glasses and they smash them on the floor, and they say this law has been going on since the universe began, which something like 14 billion years ago. But if it's true that the universe is going to a stage of more and more chaotic disorder, how come that when it started in a cosmic explosion, it actually, 14 billion years ago, it's somehow out of that 14 billion years ago, looking rather ordered today? There's ordered stars and ordered suns and planets going around the stars, and on the planets there's life and there's plants and there's rocks and there's objects and there's you and me. How come that this disorder universe that has a predilection to go downhill to disorder is actually showing order? Now again, there's a technical debate about this, and some people say, well, the second law of thermodynamics applies to what's called systems in equilibrium. It's an end point, not actually systems that are sort of half and half in transition. But even so, it just doesn't seem kind of right somehow. This idea that we're in this sort of rather chaotic material universe that's actually deteriorating, when all around about us we see structure. Again and again we see structure. So there's these deep technical problems in science. I'm going to now approach a suggested answer to this, because the paper that was posted up on the internet on March the 9th is a radical suggestion about how at a stroke we turn a minus, the problem of wondering where order is, to a plus. In the meantime, I want to say one other huge problem in science. If I look around the world, if I look around the room, if I look around anywhere, living systems are everywhere. Indeed, when you look at this planet, living systems have made the planet habitable for us. Well, a real, real problem in science is that nobody seems able to say what science means by life. This seems quite extraordinary. I can, in some ways, because my training's in physics, I can some ways make sort of humorous, pointed remarks at biologists, because I'm ignorant, very, really, really, really ignorant of biology, and I have a total admiration for some of the achievements, for example, biologists in medicine. I have that achievement because, for instance, when one goes to the dentist, my goodness, the amazing things that the dentist can do when you go into a hospital, totally brilliant things they can do. You go in worried and you come out feeling much better. So people in medicine, people in biology can do extraordinary things. But biology in some ways seems to be a practical subject. Because when you ask a biologist the fundamental question about what your science is about, and the biologist says, my science is about living things, and you say, okay, what's life? And at that point, it really becomes very difficult. It's a great test. If you feel in awe of a biologist, the more famous they are, the better it is to do. You just simply have to say, what's life? And I have to say, I tried to write definitions. In fact, we had a bursary examination for Edinburgh University when I was at school, and one of the questions was, what's life? And I remember trying to write it, and I ended up having no idea. Does it mean something that reproduces itself, but machines can copy themselves, so it can't be that? Is it something that thinks? Well, again, we see computers that can think. We're told they're going to get more and more able to think. What exactly do we mean by life? And it's not at all straightforward. We might say now that life is genes and it's DNA. But then people who think about the possibility of life on other planets say, well, can you really be sure? We're looking at life on one single planet here. Life contains the DNA, is a code. Suppose the code had different interpretations in some other system, who knows? Life's based on carbon here, but you can actually put silicon molecules into patterns. Suppose you found life in silicon somewhere else. There is a series of other possibilities, and you start to realize that we've absolutely no idea. Who knows what forms life could take? So it's really, really difficult to define life. And then you think, well, in science, we really haven't gone very far. When we want to get grant funding for science, we list a lot of successes that science has done, and we say science is making ever cheaper computer printers that require ever more expensive computer ink from the suppliers. We say that science is building better, faster and faster cars that cost more and more to tax on the road, and so on and so on. We took all these material benefits from science, and the truly staggering things, the knowledge that can be found, a few fragments of light, and one can go back 14 billion years. So these are incredible achievements. But then you think, well, what's more fundamental than the question of what is life? Now, a number of scientists know this, I've known this over the years, and have actually tried to keep the rest of us with our nose in the right direction. For example, Schrödinger, the man who developed the wave equation, the man who's one of the founding fathers of quantum theory, one of the finest physicists of all time. Schrödinger gave a lecture in the early 1950s to the Institute of Advanced Studies in Dublin, where he was professor. And Schrödinger said, one of the questions that I'm sure you would like to ask me is, what is life? Let me tell you, he said, I'll rephrase that. The fundamental question, he said, is, what is science? What is science all about? What is the purpose of science? And the audience thought a little, and they thought, is science about knowledge about the material world? Is it about making things, tackling problems? Schrödinger said, the aim of science, the fundamental aim of science, is to carry out the instructions of the philosopher Plotinus, or the question raised by the oracle at Delphi, who are we? Plotinus said, we, who are we anyway? The oracle at Delphi said, get to know yourself. Schrödinger said, it's very simple, every one of us is totally ignorant about where we came from or where we go. All we know is where we are at the moment in this life. And he said, that's my situation just as much as you. I don't know where we came from. I don't know where we're going. But I want to find out. It's pretty important, obviously, to find out. From my point of view, he said, my approach, all I can do is look around this material world, see if I can study the material world, and see if I can get any clues. Now, that's the scientific approach. Obviously, the theological approach, the approach of the mystic, there's various other approaches, and people will say, yes, they can break through the barrier and understand or get insights. But Schrödinger was saying about what the scientific approach was, which actually complements if you look at it like that, complements very neatly the approach of the other ones. So he said, that's my situation the same as the rest of you. I want to know exactly what's behind those two barriers. And all I can do is look around and study in the material world. Based on that, when we look around, we've got this fact that it is very, very, very difficult to define what we mean by life. And if you want to go further and ask a scientist what we mean by consciousness, that's extremely difficult as well. And indeed, if you even want to ask a scientist what would it mean by order, there are considerable problems in that. So I want to do a quick kind of resume of how we got there and see if there's another way of looking at this. Let's go back now a few thousand years. One of the interesting things in learning to understand science is to go to the source. Again, Schrödinger said that. Schrödinger was fascinated by the Greeks and Greek philosophy because he said if you want to find error, it's easier to find it at the source where it's raw and open rather than later when it gets covered up. Also, of course, he says, you in any case, in any discipline, want to know what your founders, the masters, have done. But error can be easier found at the source. Well, we know that if we go back to the Neolithic period, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, we're clearly dealing with scientists. We find, for example, at ancient sites like the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney, it seems to be the remains of 60 stones. It's clearly organized. If people are counting in 60s, they're mathematical. We use 60s today, times 6 for the 360 degrees of the circle, 60 for the number of seconds in a minute, number of minutes in the hour. So these people were mathematical. Interestingly, they were scientists of a quite incredible level. They developed the plants we use today, for example. Now that was pretty good going because in a number of cases they took wild plants that look very, very different from the plants we use today. There's a beautiful example that comes from Mexico. The theory about the origin of maize, which seems to have developed in Central America about 7,000 years ago, is it came from a wild grass called teosinte. The strange thing is that when you look at pictures of this wild grass called teosinte, it looks absolutely nothing like maize. It doesn't have ears on it, it doesn't have cobs on it, it just looks like a fairly ordinary wild grass. It's so different that it was only about 10 years ago that link was absolutely confirmed by DNA analysis when researchers showed that the DNA in teosinte seems to be the same as the DNA in maize. And one of the experiments that somebody with a great deal of patience is trying now is actually to crossbreed teosinte grass. Very slowly and patiently, he's crossbreeding teosinte grass and hoping that eventually he'll find something with a little bit of a mutation on a cob. And when he gets the ones with the cobs, he'll breed them a bit. And he could be at this, I dare say he'll need to have successors after him because this is something that's going to take a very long time. However, at one of the Mexican universities, in the Mexican state of Michoacán, there's a university with a quite wonderful title. It's called the Michoacán University of St. Nicholas of Hidalgo. And the Michoacán University of St. Nicholas of Hidalgo was founded a long time ago, in 1540, really a long time. It makes it the oldest college in America. Well, around that area of this college is an ancient people called the Huichol. And an important part of their diet is tortillas made from maize. These are some of the people who were in America when the Spanish came. The chemistry department at the university wondered about the origin, this question about the origin of maize coming from teosinte. And they thought, well, these people, the Huichol round about us, are very ancient people. An important part of their diet is indeed the tortillas, the maize. Maize matters to them. Maybe if we just ask these people, they might tell us. And the Huichol people said, well, we've a story about the origin of maize. We say that a young man met the mother of maize. She introduced him to her five daughters, who symbolize the five colors that maize could come in: white, red, yellow, spotted, and blue. And the mother of maize gave the young man tortillas to eat and a drink made from maize called atole. And she then said, I've given you something to eat, given you something to drink. I would now like you to choose one of my daughters as your wife. And, say the weak old people, he took the girl of Blue Maize, who the story says was the most beautiful and sacred of all. Now, the chemistry department of the Michoacán University said, that's very, very interesting. The young man had to choose five colours of maize from the girdles, and five colours of maize, and he made a good choice, the blue one, because, and they all liked their tortillas, they said the blue tortillas are definitely the most delicious. So it looks as if this legend has a bit of sense in it. But what they also noticed is that as regards colour in maize, it has a genetic aspect. The different colours of maize are connected to a particular gene in the plant. If the gene's switched on, you get blue maize. If it's switched off, you get the other colours. And there is that, in a way, difference between blue maize and the other one. Switch on, blue, switch off, it gets the other colours. So again, the choice of the blue girl and the blue maize was quite good. That meant the gene needs to be switched on. So the Michoacán University Chemistry Department said, well, let's do something to see if we can find what'll switch this gene on or off. In other words, what'll change the colours of maize. And they said, what do you find in nature? And they noticed, according to the studies, heavy metals would do it. And they said copper might be worth investigating because the biochemistry of copper is well known. So what did they do? They got some teosinte seeds. They treated them with copper sulfate at the moment of germination. They followed the various changes as the copper was absorbed into the plant, and they noticed three changes happened. One, the hard seed cover of the teosinte was lost. And that's a vital stage in going from teosinte to maize. Think of corn on the cob, the sweet version of maize. You want to get that hard cover off so that you can get it nice and succulent. So when they put this copper around about it, it actually changed. It lost the hard seed cover. Secondly, the starch levels rose. Again, if you're wanting making a food plant, you want more starch. Thirdly, some of the seeds fused together to produce something like an ear. So in a oneer, they had done something that it's very hard to do with simply selecting and crossbreeding. They'd taken a giant step towards transforming teosinte into maize. And they even came up with a theory about what may have happened. It's a volcanic area, so there could in the past have been enough heavy metal coming from the volcanic eruptions, enough heavy metal in the water to make this genetic step to actually have affected the teosinte plant. And the ancestors of the Huichol people, who would have been hunters, gatherers, who would have known the wild grasses very, very precisely, those ancestors could have spotted a mutated plant and could have simply investigated and then done some more crossbreeding to have developed it. But that's a possibility. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is that it gives us this story is an example, and in this case we've got a degree of research, but it suggests to us that, particularly for material scientists, that stories, legends, folklore from the past should be treated with great respect. The older they are, the more uninterrupted the line, the more they should be treated with respect. Because, as in this particular case, a chemistry department got an insight into a possible, they're not saying a definite, but a possible means of the development of a food plant 7,000 years ago, getting a window into a past. Now, on that basis, can we look at any other ancient legends and see if any of those ancient legends give us a clue as to how our thinking about that shaped modern science developed? And one of the important things I want to say is we think of modern science as taking shape in the last 350 years. And indeed, these huge strides were taken. But there was a long, long period when a number of fundamental ideas, deep ideas about concepts like matter, space, and time were also taking shape. Concepts that we think on today. And if we go back, it's almost like a kind of psychoanalysis of ourselves. We have to go back far enough. And I'm going to go back a considerable distance now to show a possible route whereby a particular picture of the universe developed that is built in, like a mindset, built in deeply, deeply into science. This time, I'm going to go to another part of South America, the cloud forests of Ecuador, where there are people called the Jivaro or the Shuar. These people are extremely, or rather were extremely fierce because the modern world has reached them now. They're quite fierce. They were headhunters. They were so fierce that they drove out the Spanish conquistadors and kept them out, although they had considerable deposits of gold in their area, which was quite an achievement. They're also very social people. They have a rich community life. And they have some stories that appear to go back a long time. They have a story about the origin of pottery and the origin of agriculture. They say that a long time ago, the sky and the earth were nearer each other, and sun and moon would come down to the earth to visit us. And they say sun and moon shared the same wife. And they fought and argued because she told the moon she preferred the sun, who was rather warmer than the cold moon. The moon got annoyed when he heard about it and retreated back up into the sky on a vine that was the link between the earth and the sky. The woman climbed after and he cut the vine. She fell to earth. Some versions say her body became potter's clay. Some other versions say she was carrying a basket that had pumpkins, and these pumpkins fell to earth to become the plants we know today. It's most interesting certainly from a scientific point of view, because it's saying some very interesting things about origins. It says that in some way agriculture started out of a catastrophe. Somebody fell, something cosmic fell, and out of that catastrophe came agriculture. But it's actually saying something else about the world we live in. It's saying it's structured and it's ordered. It's saying that potter's clay, which is to me, potter's clay is totally unstructured and is just a sludge. It says potter's clay may look on the outside totally unstructured and being a sludge, but it's far from that. It's actually the remains of the body of a cosmic, someone cosmic who was once alive. It's dead now, it's dead, but it was once alive. It's not unstructured. It was once alive, it's no longer alive, it's dead. And that's telling us that there is a deep, complex structure within the world, even to the extent that things on the surface do not appear to have a structure, has this deep, deep internal structure. Now, that is an absolutely key point, because if we now fast forward to 2,500 years ago, to when the Greeks laid down so much of our thinking today, the fundamental thing, the breakthrough with the Greeks was simply that, to say that we live in an ordered universe. We live in an ordered universe which we can probe, which we can analyze, and which we can structure. And the powers in the universe, whether destructive or creative, the powers that are manifest in the material sense are actually controlled and part of an organized structure. So the Greeks' breakthrough that so much comes from was made 2,500 years ago. But here in the cloud forests of Ecuador, the Jivaro are telling us something that looks as if it goes a long way back. In different parts of the world, there are different ideas about the origins of agriculture and the ideas of pottery. But this particular one of the Jivaro is really fascinating because it appears to take us through to the modern picture of matter that we have in science. Science is where we deal with matter rather than mind, for example. Fast forward again, that was 2,500 years ago. When we now move forward into the more modern time, we have the split that Descartes gave us with the material external world on the one side, characterized by spatial measurements, and the interior world, the world of spirit, of life. And science, he said, was out there to study the external world. So science studies the material world. I spent a lot of time thinking about this story, and I thought about this story for many, many years. And in fact, I got thought about this story so much that I locked into it, that I missed something big, and I missed something fundamental. This story, you can look at it in another sense. If you go back again to the Greeks. There was a big debate among the Greeks between Aristotle and Plato. Aristotle said substance is the key. If you understand what the substance of the world is, you understand it. And that's very much in line with this language I'm talking about matter. Plato, on the other hand, said no, substance isn't so important, it's form. Plato said that what shapes the world down here is the forms from up above. If you think of the world as a pot, Aristotle would have said what matters is the clay. Plato would actually say what matters is the potter who shapes the clay into forms. But in our modern world, substance is again and again and again is what we've been looking at in science, and matter. Again, there's a technical problem, because science consists of the material world, which we break down into particles, fundamental particles, the so-called building blocks. But when we do that, we discover that the particles can't be left on their own. They can't do it themselves. We have something called the laws of physics. But we have absolutely no language in which to express the laws of physics, where they live. I mean, where do the laws of physics exist in the universe? We know this universe consists of material objects, but where do the laws of physics exist? Did they come into being when the universe came into being? But if so, where are they? What nature is their existence? The problem is, we've focused so much on Aristotle's side of the argument, substance, that we forgot completely what Plato was saying about form. And form is much more about the language for the laws of physics. Furthermore, if we talk about a world of matter, it's a world of objects and things, material things. And that's very much a world of geometry, geometrical shapes, numbers. So that's the material world. Now, at this point, as I say, I was so keen on this particular paper. I thought, how nice, from the Hevero legend of pottery and the material world, I can go to ordered matter in the Greeks, I can follow it through from Aristotle to substance, and I get the scientific matter today. And it was only when I gave a talk about this, and somebody said, what on earth's this story about pottery? How can you generalize from pottery and potter's clay to everything else? That I realized I had made a huge and fundamental mistake. And my huge and fundamental mistake was I had focused so much on the dead bit, on the pottery, on the clay, on the catastrophe that it had come, that I had clean forgot of the living bit. I had forgotten the fact that if we're being told that pottery in this ancient story, the ancient world picture, if we're being told that pottery is the remains of a cosmic being that crashed to Earth, well, the point was, what happened? What about the rest of the universe? Not if we're only looking at the catastrophe. We're not actually looking at the complete picture. And then I realized that the ancient people and what made ancient world particularly significant was that ancient people saw the whole world as alive. They saw nature as a mother who absorbed the dead and brings the dead into new life every spring. And I realized that I had turned away from that when I was so focusing on the dead bit, on the pottery. The bit I should have been looking at is the regenerating bit. The fact is that one bit broke down. It's a bit like the machine. You look at the bit that breaks down and it annoys you, but you don't notice the bit that keeps on functioning all the time. And the ancient world view was actually about a living universe rather than a dead one. And then I thought a bit and I said to myself, well, what is the difference? If you suppose we start our science with a living universe instead of a dead one, would it be any different? What kind of science would we come to? In other words, rather than starting with my story of the pottery, the dead matter, and following it on to dead lumps of matter, what if I had actually started with a living universe and said what it would be like? Well, a dead universe consists of objects, just things that stay the same, pieces. What would a living universe consist of? Well, a living universe wouldn't consist of objects. A living universe would consist of processes. If we look around us, the fundamental characteristic of life is it changes. You think of a seed. The seed grows incredibly into a plant. The plant ages and goes back. What's going on in a living universe is process and change. A dead universe is when it stops, it sticks. Our language that we use, generally speaking, is the language of a dead. Too often we use the language of a dead universe. We speak about things like time as objects. We say, I'd like to save time, as if you save time like money in a bank. You say, I'll give you some time, like you give somebody sweets. We talk about processes rather like objects. We speak about ideas. We say, do you see my point of view? Highly visual, object language. You don't have a point of view, but we talk about this geometrical object language. We even speak about ourselves as objects, but none of us is an object. Every one of us is a process. It's a process that started when we were born and a process that ends when we die. And that's why if you wanted to have a photograph of somebody, in an obituary, people say, well, what picture should I take of somebody? Should I take a picture of them when they were younger? Should I take a picture of them older? And you can't say any one picture is them because they are a totality. They are a process. So in a living universe, and a science coming from a living universe, the science would have to be a science of processes. Now, that becomes very interesting because you can actually think about a science of processes instead of a science of object. Turns out, for example, when we get down to the very small things in nature, areas like quantum theory, things don't look nearly as solid as they do in the material world. It looks much more like we're dealing with a process. When you take light, for example, light in many cases is much more of a process than a thing. But quite remarkably, in mathematics, you can actually make a choice. Mathematics, if we think of as the language of science, in mathematics, you can actually choose whether you have process language or whether you have object language. Object language for dead matter, for a dead universe, is geometry. Very simply, this is not going to change. This is not going to change like a plant. This, I know if I put this in the ground and pour water on it, it might curl up a little, but it won't grow into a plant. So this is dead, and the language of this is geometry. It's a language of right angles and straight lines. Dead, a material universe, the language is geometry. Question is, what would the language for a living, the mathematics for a living universe be? Well, amazingly, you can answer that question. The language for a dead universe is about space, objects laid out in front of you. The language for a living universe is about time, because a process unwinds in time. Matter stays in space, a process unwinds in time. Therefore, we need to find a mathematics that's fundamentally about change, that's purely about change. Now, we can actually do it. In fact, we all know it. Everyone in this room knows a mathematics that is purely about change. And that's numbers, the theory of numbers. Because the difference between 1 and 2 is purely change. 2 and 3, it's a language of change and a language of time. And there are some quite remarkable things that you can do with numbers, things that are really a surprise. And I'm going to do, this is the only part of the diagram what I'm going to do. I'm going to show numbers, a pattern you can make with numbers. That's two numbers. 1 and 1, and I'm going to add them up, and as it's Friday afternoon, I'm not really going to do anything that's too that's too challenging for me to remember. But I'm now going to add up every 2, and I'm going to make a kind of line of numbers that kind of grows organically, a bit like a plant kind of grows. I'm going to add 1 and 2, and I'm going to make 3. And every time I'm going to add 2 numbers, I'm going to make a third one. So 2, 3 makes 5, and I'm sure you're already ahead of me with the next one, aren't you? There we go. We go up to 13. Keep going. We go up to 21, and it actually grows quite big after a while. 34, and it keeps going. And this is a theory of numbers. Now, you might say, well, you can't really get much more simple than that. I've just made a few numbers. When you go out for a walk outside, you actually find these numbers. For example, When you look at the number of petals on a flower, believe it or not, they're usually in that pattern. Gardeners here will know this better than me, but apparently a lily or an iris has three petals, buttercups have five, chicory has 21, a daisy has 34, or the next one, 55. It just happens. The flowers seem to form these particular patterns. When you look at the heads of sunflowers, it turns out that the seeds on a sunflower head fall into a series of spiral curves. There's a whole family of spirals the one way and a whole family the other way. The strange thing is, if you count the number of curves in the one family, you'll find a number in that sequence. If you count the number of curves in the other lot of, you'll also find a number in that sequence. I find that most totally and utterly extraordinary. There are some reasons. Some people say that there are reasons to it. It's to do with the nature, the way a plant grows. So it's not as if it's magical. It is this. It's kind of to do with ideas about growth. But this particular pattern of numbers seems to come again and again and again when you look at growing plants. At the one hand, to do with, like I say, petals, spirals of sunflower seeds, and you can also find various proportions in the way a shell grows. There, a shell again is growing, building up organically. These numbers seem to be the ideal mathematics to talk about growth and form. And indeed, a mathematician at St Andrews University called Darcy Thompson wrote a book in the late 1940s on growth and form. And it's a book that for many years people thought it was really beautiful, fascinating, but they couldn't quite see where it fitted into the scheme of things. This particular series of numbers has been known for a long time. A mathematician called Leonardo of Pisa discovered this. He was called, after his father was called Bonacci, and he was known by the Latin name, nickname, Filius Bonacci, Fibonacci for short. And this is the Fibonacci sequence, or the Fibonacci numbers. It turns out that Fibonacci numbers, when we look at the living world, Fibonacci numbers come again and again. And this another strange thing you can do, and again it's fun with a calculator, but if you divide each number by the one before it, 1 divided by 1 is 1, 2 divided by 1 is 2, 3 divided by 2 is 1.5, and so on. You actually come to, and if you, 34 over 21, and you can actually do it, you come to a number which is this, 618034. And this number is a special one. Artists know it. This is the famous golden ratio. It's to do with proportions. The proportions of the human body, if you draw the proportions of squares and rectangles. Again, I won't go into the details. It's something that's fascinating to look at. But suddenly, out of this and plants, we're actually coming to something that's a lot more to do with life, ideal proportions of a body. Did I think the medieval cathedrals were laid out in the proportions of a body? But this number is a fascinating. So out of these little numbers is coming something. Now, what I'm now saying is going on here is I think that we are now talking a different kind of mathematics from the geometry. This is not the mathematics of dead matter. This is the mathematics of living systems. But I'm then saying that you can actually talk of two different kinds of mathematics for two different kinds of universe. This point, I recently came across a brilliant book by a brilliant mathematician. This is one of the great mathematical communicators, Ian Stewart. And he wrote this book about 10 years ago, and it's really strange because at the time it got some publicity. He is an outstanding mathematician, outstanding communicator. But I really don't think that either the people read this book remembered what they were reading, or the people who ought to have read the book read it. Because he simply says, he calls it life's other secret. He says the one secret of life's DNA. But he said DNA is simply the recipe. You actually have to know what it is you're making. And this is about the mathematics of living systems. And he talks about the Fibonacci series. And he basically says, and it's I think for anyone who gets slightly depressed sometimes about the materialistic language that some areas of science can be used in, this is very different. He talks about the importance of DNA, the brilliant work that's done in DNA, but he said that's only one part of it. That's only the pieces. What we actually have to do is to work out how the pieces fit together. So he takes some of these ideas and takes them a stage further. So we've got then two pictures of the world as living or dead, two types of mathematics as living as dead. And it's interesting because when you start to look at this, some things that the ancient Greeks suddenly start to make sense. For example, Pythagoras, the Greek mathematician, was particularly interested in number. And this is what Aristotle says about his followers. Aristotle says, they assumed that the elements of numbers were the elements of all things, and that the whole heavens were harmony and number. The whole universe, the fundamental essence of the universe was harmony and number. One of the Pythagoreans said, number is the principle, the source, and the root of all things. Very different then from the material universe. They're making the universe out of numbers. You might say that that's a bit material, but number really, by its very abstraction, is far from being material. And we're opening the door, just gently, we're moving in the direction of a universe of order and form as the fundamental rather than matter. This is the language of living systems, order and form. And I should just say, one of the fascinating things is that some of the geometrical mathematics, the mathematics I said of dead matter, you can actually form a bridge between this and that. For example, we're used to doing Pythagoras' theorem in terms of right-angled triangles and squares and so on. Turns out that every second number here is the hypotenuse of a Pythagorean triangle. Goodness knows how. It's so extraordinary to see it. But there's a 5. It's a Pythagorean triangle with integral sides. A 3, 4, 5 triangle, a 5, 12, and so on. But there seems to be a kind of Pythagoras theorem pattern coming out of that. And one of the thoughts, and that it turns out that there are some mathematicians starting to raise it, one of the thoughts is, could one start with this and see if one could actually get the mathematics, as I called it, of dead matter out of the mathematics of living matter? Could one do it? And some people are wondering. And I should say there are other types of mathematics like this that seem to be more connected with process. Some deep and very beautiful parts of mathematics. So that was how, through this, I had got more and more to think that fundamentally I had got it wrong. I'd looked at the wrong end. I'd so concerned with the material world, I had missed this ancient idea that the universe was alive. At that point, and it was March this year, and I happened to look on the internet for the website of one of the most brilliant physicists of our day, Professor Brian Josephson. He's a Nobel Prize winner. He got the Nobel Prize for work he did as a graduate researcher in superconductivity. So absolutely brilliant research. And he's got a brilliant mind because he's totally honest. He's totally logical. And that means that any issue in science that he thinks has not been given fair treatment or assessed fairly, he'll speak up for it, whatever the consequences. And he's suffered for that because he's been at times marginalised and at times criticised. But as he says himself, one of the great advantages of having a Nobel Prize is they can't really, if you want to speak your mind, they can't really do very much about it. On the 9th of March this year, he posted up on his website a talk that he had given the Cambridge University Physics Society 4 days before. And what he said is simply revolutionary. He starts his account by noting, and I quote, "Current physics implicitly assumes matter is fundamental, life and mentality being secondary." I'll repeat that because it's so important. He says, current physics, implicitly, it's built into its thinking, that matter is fundamental, and that life and mentality, mind, is secondary. And I've been telling you how my story, how I had gone to that story of the origin of pottery, and I'd focused so much on the dead part of the universe that I had missed the significance of the living part. Brian Josephson says if you start with this idea that matter is fundamental and that life and mentality is sacred, if you start on that, you get a whole series of problems and you've sooner or later got to face them. He goes into these problems. And so, he said, it isn't working. Let's be honest. Let's simply say it's not working. In other words, he said, we've started, let's face facts, we've started at the wrong end. We've started with matter as fundamental. It's not working. Let's go to the other end. Let us start with life and mind, life and mentality. He says, his words are, let us start by saying, assuming that, quote, life and mentality emerge from a more fundamental level of existence. What an incredible thought. Life and mentality emerge from a more fundamental level of existence. In other words, he says, we've started at the wrong end in physics. We've looked at dead matter and we've hoped that somehow life will emerge from it as a kind of byproduct. We think that if we stick enough atoms together, we get molecules, and you stick enough molecules together, you get cells, and stick enough cells together. Somehow you get me. You just keep sticking these things. But at what point? He said, that's the point. Well, at what point did you stick all these bits together? At what point did it become alive? What point? He said, these are fundamental questions. So his suggestion is go totally rethink it. Start at the other end. Say that there is deep, deep down a deep level of existence below the level of the material world. And deep down at that level of existence, there is something that is manifesting to us as order or life or consciousness or mind. This is the language of Plato. This is form, looking at form, not matter. I should say one other physicist came very close to this language, a brilliant man called David Bohm. Bohm actually said that both consciousness and matter are the building blocks of the universe, that consciousness and matter come out of something deeper. And he simply says, I call it what is. I don't have words for it. It's what is. So, putting all that together, and you have a total and radical, a call for a total and radical transformation of science. But a radical transformation that actually is appealing, or should appeal, to the professional physicist who has got tough technical problems of physics to solve. The fact, of course, that it tends to encourage the rest of us, and suddenly, in a rather dark and dead approach to the world, suddenly brings a touch of spring about it, is a bonus. I thought of this the other night, actually, and the cat at home came in, and the cat was extremely proud of itself. It brought in this little field mouse, and incredibly, not for any altruistic reason, it had kept it totally alive. It was obviously wanting to let it go and chase it again and keep doing it, but it hadn't harmed it in the slightest. And I looked at this little field mouse, and I saw its little paws and these little glittering eyes and the whiskers that were twitching. And I thought, well, at the moment, my model of physics, and I sort of half spoke to the cat and the field mouse and said, well, you do realize that my model of physics at the moment, up to now, has been that really 14 billion years ago, there was an explosion, and that all the particles and the pieces of the explosion came together and formed cells and molecules. And actually, they sort of came together and agglutinated and produced you. And I thought, well, no, I don't think that is quite the model. Now, I need to make several things clear, however, when we're doing this. We're not, Brian Josephson is talking as a physicist to physicists. He's calling for something totally radical, and it opens the door for very, very fresh thinking. He's not falling into one side or the other on the long-running evolution versus intelligent design argument. It doesn't necessarily help or hinder either side. He's not simply not interested. He's not the sort of person that takes sides. What he's actually saying, however, is that in physics, it's not simply now, and in science, it's not simply that there's a material world and that everything else has been banned by kind of rule. life, mind, consciousness, spirit, order. Far from it, he said. That's there. Indeed, that's primary and that's fundamental. It seems to me, although he did not say the consequences, it seems to me that that opens the way for a fundamental rethink and a very, very stimulating dialogue between science and theology. Because if we are looking at order and mind and consciousness as fundamental, it just seems to me there is much more common ground. I'll be interested to see what you think of that. But it certainly seems to me that this is very different from the dead pieces of matter. I think Hildegard of Bingen would have liked it when she said 9 years ago, the soul is in the body as the sap is in the tree. Will is like the flowers on the tree. Mind like the first fruit bursting forth. She talked about the soul in the body as the sap in the tree. And in a way, what's happening with Brian Josephson's picture is we're looking at the soul in the body, the sap in the tree, something, order, life that is driving the material world. The Orkney poet Robert Rendell spoke of the flow of life in nature, and he said, "Constant beyond all change of sky or soil lies fenced the mystery of the living shoot, green involutions of the mind." The mystery of the living shoot. Again, the language is about life. A century ago, Alfred North Whitehead, who was a master of logic, a keen eye for physics, he had worked with Bertrand Russell trying to build up mathematics out of logic, and did a massive amount of work. So somebody who certainly would quite capable of handling some of the hardest and toughest areas of mathematics and physics. But Whitehead said, the universe is alive, and process is the fundamental feature. He said, existence is activity ever merging into the future. So, to conclude, I think, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts and questions and discussion, as of the 9th of March this year, the whole of physics has changed. It may take years for the message to spread because it's so radical. But, at a stroke, Brian Josephson has opened up radical solutions to old problems, and he's opened up exciting routes to new discoveries. The new physics sees life as fundamental. It's what our ancestors did thousands of years ago in the Neolithic. It's what so many cultures around the world do who live close to nature. And it seems to me that this new physics takes forward some of the thinking of the older cultures and refreshes and revitalizes the stream of ideas that goes back to the Greeks, but which has seemed in recent years to be running dry. What I think this is suggesting will emerge in the years ahead is a physics of ancient cultures and modern analysis, a physics of sunflowers and seashells. And sometimes I think in a dark world, in a dark winter, maybe that's just a very small green shoot of spring. Thank you.